Genesis chapter 33, verses 1 through 11. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau, coming with 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. He put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground seven times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given your servant." Then the maidservant and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, "What do you mean by all these droves I met?" "To find favor in your eyes, my lord," he said. But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." "No, please," said Jacob. "If I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God. Now that you have received me favorably, please accept the present that was brought to you. For God has been gracious to me, and I have all my need." And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. God's word this morning. Go ahead and have a seat. When I first started working on this particular message for Jacob, it was actually a message that had a lot more challenges to it as compared to, you look at Noah, people know the stories of Noah, and you look at Abraham, it's really easy to see the areas in those people's lives where they needed faith to do what God was calling them to do. That's not quite the same thing with Jacob. It's quite a challenge to find faith in the story of Jacob because Jacob was quite a character from beginning to end. And so when you're trying to look at faith and you're looking at Jacob's story and time and again you're encountering Jacob being selfish, seeking to gain things for himself, doing what he can to save his own skin and self-preservation, you see everything but faith. He will do whatever it takes to gain things that aren't his, and he will do whatever it takes to save his own hide. His brother Esau is starving, but instead of helping his brother like a loving brother should, he instead says, "Hey, well, give me your birthright, and I'll give you some stew." When Isaac is ready to give out the blessings to his kids, Jacob goes through an elaborate routine to steal the blessing too. Jacob is unloving towards his first wife, Leah. He himself becomes the swindler, becomes the swindled. He gets a little trick played on him, and he ends up with this wife that he really didn't want, he really doesn't love. And so he ends up being an unloving husband to his first wife, Leah. And then when his father-in-law is wanting him to stay, he's been blessed because of Jacob's presence. Jacob is wanting to go, but his father-in-law wants him to stay. So his father-in-law puts together an elaborate gift for Jacob to stay. And Jacob says, "Okay, I'll take it. I'll take the gifts. I'll stay." And then he turns around and runs off with the gifts and and his wives. So going through there, I finally came to the conclusion, after going through his story different times, I came to the conclusion that Jacob must have had, in a very literal sense, mustard seed faith. Mustard seed faith that was so small you couldn't see it, because I was looking through trying to find it, and it was really difficult. And as I would read through the life of Jacob, I would come across the story we just read. And I would bump into that story, and I would be like, "I really like this story. I love this story. It's a great story, but it doesn't have anything to do with faith." And so I would go back through and, okay, let's try and find faith in the story of Jacob. And then I had one of those duh moments. Maybe you've had a duh moment before. It's the opposite of an aha moment. A lot of times you have an aha light bulb moment where you have this divine revelation or something really important, something really significant that you weren't expecting, and it's just a brilliant idea. A duh moment is when you're looking for your glasses and you've got them up on the top of your head and, you know, you're like, "Oh, duh, I should have known that. I should have seen that." Maybe you've spent time looking frantically for something for 10, 15 minutes only to find out that it's sitting in plain sight right where you should have seen it and you missed it. That's what I mean by a duh moment. And as I kept bumping into this story, finally I reached a point where all of a sudden I had this duh moment when it came to the story of Jacob's reconciliation with his brother. It was one of those things where I didn't think faith was in that story, and then when it came to the realization that faith is all over the place in that story. But before we look at the story of Jacob and Esau's reconciliation, I want us to first look at the reconciliation that occurs between God and mankind. Because that is what we learn from that reconciliation is where we see a lot of the significance of faith. In Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 through 9, we read this: "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this not from yourselves, it is a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast." There are two things that happen in our reconciliation with God that occur by faith. By faith, we see that God's standard, and know that we fall short of it. Prior to a faith that sees our true predicament in relation to God, we have eyes that judge our lives on the basis of our own standards. We give ourselves tests that are easy for us to pass. As it says in Proverbs chapter 21, verse 2, "All a man's ways seem right to him, but the Lord weighs the heart." When we grade our own lives using our own eyes, it's almost like we have filters that allow us to only see the good things. Or we have filters that affect our eyes in a way where it just downplays the negative things, or the negative, the selfish inclinations or the motives. Or in the process of grading our own lives, we put our tests alongside some of the worst people that humanity has to offer. Sure, my life may seem maybe far from perfect, but I look like an angel compared to Hitler, or Stalin, or Nero, or the person that still writes checks in the checkout line at the grocery store and does that after using about 20 coupons. All of those people are evil equally. When we judge our own lives using our own eyes, of course we look awesome. When we judge our own lives using our own eyes in comparison to the evil people of the world, of course, we look like saints. But when we look at our lives through faith, we see and believe God's standard, and we see and believe that we fall short of that standard. The passage that we just read about in Ephesians earlier highlights the fact that the hope we have of being reconciled to God or being restored in our relationship with God is not found in our works. There is no offering or gift or sacrifice that we can offer up that will fix the situation that you and I have in our relationship with God. Attempts to try and balance out the scales where our good deeds outweigh our bad are attempts that are made in the absence of faith. By faith, we see that our hope of reconciliation is rooted in the sufficient and complete work of Christ, in his life, death, and his resurrection. Faith sees that reconciliation as a possibility only exists because God has made reconciliation a possibility and not ourselves. This requires an unbelievable amount of humility. Pride says that I can fix this, I can make this relationship right. But humility says only God can fix this situation. Only God can make this relationship right. It is by faith that we recognize the problem, and it is by faith that we see God's solution. And here's where I found, this is where that duh moment happened for me. While it's easy for me to think about faith in the context of restoring our relationship with God, I wasn't really thinking about that faith in the context of restoring our relationships with other human beings. One of the byproducts of a broken relationship with God is a broken relationship with others. And one of the byproducts of a restored relationship with God is a restored relationship with others. The same faith that enables us to see clearly the problem and the solution as it relates to our relationship with God are the same eyes of faith that help us see and recognize the problems and the solutions when it comes to our relationships with others. So, now let's go back to the story of Jacob and Esau. There's a lot that actually happens. So that was in chapter 33. Go ahead and flip back to chapter 32. That's where we're going to be spending more of our time. There's actually a lot of things that happened prior to the reconciliation encounter that we read about already. So go ahead and turn to chapter 32. At this point in chapter 32, when it gets started, Jacob is on his way back home. He's already fled from his father-in-law. He's already made a little bit of an amends there with his father-in-law as he makes his way back home. He's on his way back home, and he is fully aware that he has a justifiably angry older brother waiting for him. The last that we've seen of his brother Esau is in chapter 27, where Esau says, "The days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob." Basically, what he's saying is, my dad is old, soon I will be mourning his death, and then I'll be free to exact my vengeance. Jacob's mother is aware of the threat, and she arranges to have Jacob sent away to a more safe location. And so, in chapter 32, Jacob is on his way back, and this is a prayer we read about from the lips of Jacob. In chapter 32, we're going to read verses 9 through 12. Genesis 32, starting in verse 9. Then Jacob prayed, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and unfaithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two groups. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. There are a couple positive things that we see in this prayer by Jacob. And so the next slide, by faith, Jacob returns home. Despite the dangers, despite the threat to his own life, Jacob is going to go where God is calling him to go. Why would Jacob do that? He is blessed beyond all measure. He's got wealth, he's got a large family, and he's putting everything at risk. Or is he? In the world's eyes, he is putting everything at risk by returning home. But with eyes of faith, he is putting everything in God's faithful hands. Jacob recognizes that everything he has is a gift from God. Everything he's acquired since he crossed that river. The only thing he had was a staff. Now God has blessed him with much, much more. His prosperity was a gift from God, and it's God's duty to protect it and keep it safe as God desires. Next slide. By faith, Jacob knows he has fallen short of God's standard. We see this by what he says in verse 10. In verse 10, he says, I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness of God. His prayer for protection does not include any cries for justice against his adversaries because he knows he's the one that's been unjust in this situation. He knows his wrongs, and he knows they are great. He doesn't want to die, but he knows that he's deserving of it. We also see Jacob's recognition of his shortcomings via the huge gift that he prepares for Esau. In Genesis chapter 32, we'll start reading verse 13 through 16. Verse 13, he spent the night there, and from what he had with him, he selected a gift for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, and said to his servants, go ahead of me and keep some space between the herds. The greater the offense, the greater the penalty. And just like in today's world, if you have enough money, you can try to, in a way, buy your freedom, buy your way out of a penalty. This isn't the kind of situation that is a back-and-forth, offer-counter-offer type of proposal. Jacob has one shot at an offer that might persuade Esau to spare the lives of himself and his family. Jacob doesn't want to lowball the offer and make something that's not big enough. He's going to go big or go home, offer what he can, and see if that saves his life. He is fully aware of his guilt and fully aware that it just might cost him everything God has blessed him with. However, Jacob's first attempt at forgiveness is a complete failure. First off, it doesn't appear that the gift and his plan as far as sending these groups out with this message to Esau, it doesn't even appear that those groups ended up meeting Esau. As Jacob moved from camp to camp, he sends them in groups, each bearing a certain message. When Esau asks, to whom do you belong and where are you going? Each group is supposed to answer, they belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind us. In the story that we started off with, where the reconciliation actually happens, when Esau does embrace Jacob, Esau's question is this, what is all this? Who are all these people with you? It appears that Jacob's first attempt to pacify Esau with a bunch of gifts is not what resulted in Esau's embrace of Jacob. It seems like he didn't realize who those people were, so he didn't seem like he had any encounter before that. Second, Jacob's seeking of forgiveness is a failure because he is trying to buy his forgiveness. Like a person trying to fix a relationship with God by trying to do a bunch of good deeds, Jacob is trying to fix his relationship with Esau with a bunch of stuff. Things, even good things, costly things, cannot restore a relationship. If Jacob had encountered Esau, according to the plan that he had set into motion as far as trying to buy it with the gifts, Jacob would have always had in the back of his mind, did my brother really forgive me? Or did he just accept the stuff and just kind of put up with it? Has Esau really forgiven me? Do I need to watch my back? Is Esau only pretending? Is this another trick? For somebody that's played tricks on a lot of people, a lot of times they're paranoid about people doing the same to him. Maybe Esau really isn't forgiving me and he's got some sort of a plan that's going to return the favor onto Jacob. By faith, Jacob hoped for genuine reconciliation with Esau. When Jacob is finally reconciled with his brother Esau, things are very different than initially planned. Between Jacob's planned attempt to buy forgiveness and the time when Esau actually embraces him, in between those two events is a night where he wrestles with God, a night that left him with a new name and a limp. He is vulnerable, he is humbled, and he is at that moment at the mercy of his brother Esau in a way that he wouldn't have been a day earlier because of his physical and spiritual brokenness. He's broken in more ways than just physically. So how do we know that? We know that because we see this. Jacob limps to the head of the line. Instead of a parade of gifts and praise sent ahead of him to subdue Esau, to pacify him, to make him be more merciful, instead of that being the first thing that Esau encounters, Esau instead comes across a limping brother who betrayed him. Instead of hiding behind layers of family members and gifts and servants, Jacob is done with the hiding. Rather than having other people speak on Jacob's behalf, calling Esau Lord and Jacob his servant, instead of having servants do that, Jacob does it himself. And Jacob limps forward in humility and says it himself. Jacob's first words to Esau are this: "These are the children God has graciously given your servant." This is a significant moment in the life of Jacob. The kid who did not want to be second in line, the kid who did not want to get the second best blessing and the second best birthright, this person is now submitting to his older brother. He's submitting to another person where we haven't seen him submit to anybody before. Instead of his interests and his own self-preservation coming before everyone else's, including his wives and his children, he is now putting his interests and self-preservation in the back seat. In Philippians chapter 2, we read this. I'm going to read chapter 2, verses 3 through 7. "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness." Do nothing out of selfish ambition. When you read Jacob's story, it starts off where he is doing everything by selfish ambition. When I read the verse about how Jesus did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, I could not help but think about what Jacob's name actually meant. Maybe you're familiar with it. Jacob's name meant heel grabber or supplanter. Jacob was grasping after equality with his older brother. He wanted what Esau had, and he did successfully supplant him in terms of getting the birthright and the blessing. He wanted what Esau had, but that's not what we see with Jesus in his relationship to his father. We don't see Jesus attempting to supplant his father. Instead, we see Jesus taking the very nature of a servant. In the reconciliation of Jacob and Esau, we finally see Jacob do what his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great, I didn't add up the greats, but there's a lot of greats in between Jacob and Jesus. But he does what Jesus ends up doing, modeling for us, which is a life of perfect servanthood. Jacob has a son named Judah, and it is through the tribe of Judah that we get to Jesus. By faith, Jacob gave gifts in response to Esau's grace and mercy. I think that this part is actually really cool. the gifts that Jacob hoped would be given as a way to try and buy his salvation, so to speak, ended up being given instead as a response to the salvation that he freely received from his brother Esau. Rather than giving Esau gifts for fear of his own life, he ends up giving gifts to Esau as an expression of gratitude. The exact same gifts, the exact same thing was offered, but with an entirely different purpose. In the same way, as it pertains to faith and salvation, the purpose of good works is not to save our lives, as if we're trying to pacify God by giving him a bunch of good things, having him encounter a bunch of good things before he gets to dealing with us. Nope, that's not how it goes. Good works are a natural response of a person who has been embraced by a heavenly Father who forgives the sinner on his way home. And I know that this message is about the faith of Jacob, but we cannot overlook the way in which Esau displays godly love in the story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son is planning what he's going to say. He's hoping to be accepted back as a servant. Those plans get thrown out the window, and he's accepted by his father as a son. Jacob has his plans. He hopes to be accepted as a servant. But what happens? Those plans, out the window, as Esau embraces him and accepts him back as a brother. And then, of course, in there too, there's a little line where Jacob says, "You look like the face of God." Esau resembles what God does in the prodigal son's story. So that's what Jacob did by faith. And that's good and that's helpful. But what we need is, what can we do after having learned from Jacob? What can we do by faith as individuals and as a corporate body? By faith, we see God's standard for our relationship with others. In case you've forgotten, God's standard for our relationships with others is pretty high. Love your enemies. Don't even have a lustful thought. Consider others better than yourselves. Maybe your experience is different than mine, but there are some people out there who make it really, really easy for me to want to hate them. I go to the fitness center on a regular basis, so I try to keep in shape. And I'm supposed to be able to go there all the time while at the same time staying free from any single lustful thought. How in the world is a Jesus follower going to have any level of career success if they're constantly holding the door open figuratively for everyone else as if they're better than they are? A you-first approach may have you missing out on a promotion or even a pay raise. Make no mistake about it, this world is full of challenges for anyone who wants to live by the standard that God has for us when it comes to our relationship with others. Falling short is going to happen. And it's because we fall short that, by faith, we are a people who readily seek forgiveness. Now, I might be wrong about this. I am getting older. I don't think my mind's getting fuzzy yet. Maybe I've lost count. Maybe I don't remember it as well. But it seems like a lot of times when I hear messages about forgiveness, the messages about forgiveness focus on the way that we're supposed to forgive others. Forgive because Christ forgave us. And that's true, and that's good, and that's great. But there are two parts to the prayer in the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. When is the last time you've asked someone for forgiveness for something you've done? And family members don't count. It happens on a daily, weekly basis, I'm sure. When is the last time you've asked somebody who's not a family member for forgiveness for something that you've done? Here's an even tougher question, maybe. When is the last time you've asked someone for forgiveness for something that you didn't do? When it comes to sins, there are the sins of commission and the sins of omission. Sins of commission are what we generally think of when we think about the list of sins, sins that we actually commit, doing things that we shouldn't be doing, and so we need to ask for forgiveness. Sins of omission are sins where we don't do the things we're supposed to be doing. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, there are robbers who beat a man and leave him for dead. Those people are guilty of the sin of commission for what they did do to that man and beating him up and leaving him for dead. The priest and the Levite, however, who pass by on the other side of the road, they are guilty of something different. Guilty, but of something different. They are guilty of the sin of omission because of what they didn't do. They didn't do anything to help the man who was dying. As followers of Christ, as people of faith who recognize that we fall short of God's standard in our relationship with God and our relationship with others, we ought to be keenly aware of those times when we do fall short and seek to rectify them with humility. As we close this morning, there's actually another kind of sin I'd like to highlight. It's a kind of sin that, if I think it's probably the hardest one, especially in the time that we live in, the culture that we live in. We live at a time where there is a huge emphasis on the individual. The concept of community is lost, and at best, instead of a community, we just have a collection of individuals. Discussions about faith are usually wrapped up in a discussion about what it means to have a personal relationship with Jesus. The importance of being connected to a community of believers is lost because there is a high value on the individual. And it's in that individualistic and very personalized culture and context that something like corporate sin is actually pretty offensive to people. Corporate sin is where a community of people are guilty of the sins committed by anyone within that community. When it comes to the kids where I work, there are probably 1,000 different things that we're trying to communicate and teach these kids, far beyond just how to deal with their drug use problems and getting over that. There's a lot of behavior issues that we have to deal with. So there's a lot of things that we try to instill within them while that we have our time with them. One of the more difficult tasks on that long list of items is fostering mutual accountability amongst the residents that are there at the same time. They participate in virtually everything together as a group, from their group times to their recreation times to trips to sports events, all those things they do together as a group. They participate in all those things together as a group, and because of that, their rewards and punishments are often experienced as a group. If they're all behaving, they all get a reward. But if some of them aren't behaving, a lot of times, all of them endure the punishment to it. The kids that behave, have no problem with them, they absolutely hate that policy. Time and again, they miss out on things because one, two, or three guys just can't get it together. Why should I miss out on a trip because of him? Why should I miss out on recreation time because of them? On and on, the complaints go until finally they reach the point where it's time to stop complaining to staff about the standard that we've set for them as a group, and they have to start holding each other accountable as peers. It's an amazing thing to see what happens when peers try to hold each other accountable. It actually works. This is one of the few instances where peer pressure is actually a good thing. It promotes something positive. Teenage guys don't really care a whole lot, especially the kids that we deal with. They don't care a whole lot if staff doesn't like them, if they're rebellious, if they're not listening, if they're disobeying, if they're not following the rules. For them, that's a, I'm tough, I'm macho, watch this. I don't care what the adults say. But when you flip it around to where the peers are the ones holding each other accountable, all of a sudden things change. The teens care very much about what their peer group thinks of them. So if a kid isn't liked by their peers, that's a big problem in their book. The tribes of Israel, as we see in their story, know full well what corporate sin looks like. It looks like a bunch of people wandering around in a desert because some of them were grumbling. I'm sure some of them ended up grumbling about the fact that before the trip, they weren't the ones grumbling, but now they're the ones grumbling that they're on this trip along with them. Here's why I think the issue of corporate sin is important for any church that seeks to minister and reach out to the people in this world. There are people in this world who have been hurt by someone who was or is, or at least claimed to be, a Christian. That should not be remotely shocking to the person who was hurt, and it should not be shocking to us who've been a part of the church for any length of time. Christians make mistakes. Christians fall short. Christians sin. But when it comes to those situations and the people who are sharing those hurtful situations, your response and my response should not be, well, I didn't do that. I wasn't the one who did that. It wasn't my church that did that. You know, you can't hold us responsible for that. That's not my fault or not my church's fault. Even though you may not be guilty, and even though your church may not be guilty, you do have the ability, as a member and representative of the corporate body of Christ that is bigger than you and is bigger than this church individually, you do have the power to do something powerful, and it is this. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what happened. I'm sorry for what you've been through. I'm sorry, and we, as a church, ask for your forgiveness. There will come a day when Christ will present the church as a bride without spot or wrinkle, but we aren't there yet. Forgive us our spots and our wrinkles. Asking for forgiveness just might be one of the most difficult challenges in life, and we can only do it by faith. By faith, we ask for forgiveness in the confident hope that Christ will reconcile us back to God. And it is by faith that we ask for forgiveness in the confident hope that our relationships with others might also be reconciled and perfected. And so this morning, I do want to thank Jacob for his story. Even though it didn't look like faith in the beginning when I was first looking at it, I'm thankful for the lesson that we have in his reconciliation with Esau. We do have a song for closing this morning, and then we'll go ahead and pray.